A very warm welcome to Dr. Shannon Doherty, who has kindly agreed to come and speak. And Shannon's a fellow clinical psychologist, and you work with, she works with the Compass team. For those of you who don't know, the Compass team has been around since 2003 as a mental health liaison service within the NHS for asylum seekers. So I understand that your interest in interpreters really kind of came out of necessity, given that most of your work continues to have to involve the use of interpreters on a day-to-day basis. So that's great. And Sharon also tells me that she has been involved in training people in use, the effective use of interpreters in their work, but you've also been involved in training interpreters on the mental health front as well.
That's right, yeah.
Their understanding. Great. So without further ado, I'll give you the floor, and I think you want to sort of open things up immediately to people who maybe want to ask a few questions to direct the talk.
So I'm Sharon Doherty, and as David said, I'm a clinical psychologist. I work with asylum seekers and refugees. We're a trauma service that was set up when Glasgow became a dispersal city for asylum seekers almost a decade ago now. So my experience of using interpreters is entirely within a context of mental health. Now, I'm very aware that your disciplines, your skill mix is multidisciplinary: doctors, physiotherapists, pharmacists, psychologists, nurses. I don't know if you have any OTs. But I'm also very aware that a lot of what I talk about is drawing learning from mental health settings. What I hope is that as we go along, maybe through our discussions, we could, look at the crossover and, you know, just, make it relevant to your own practice. So I apologise if it's predominantly mental health in focus, but I do think some of the themes are universal and hopefully it'll still be useful. So to say a little bit, I thought that it would be useful, really, to structure the talk from the different perspectives of the different stakeholders in any consultation or any intervention or treatment plan. So, the patient, the clinician, and the interpreter. And hopefully, in this process, by thinking about it in this way, I'll hopefully answer the questions, some of the questions, hopefully as many as I can, that you might have about using interpreters in your own practice. And then I'd hope maybe just to come on and think about good practice when using interpreters. I'm already having questions about how does a physiotherapist use an interpreter if they're carrying out exercise plans with a client, with a patient. So there are things I haven't asked myself, I think, and it would be interesting to have some discussion around that if we have time. But before we start, I really just wanted to check how many people have had actual experience of using an interpreter in their work. You put your hand up. So everybody, pretty much. And are the patients that you work with from an Indigenous, Black and minority ethnic background? Are they asylum seekers? Are they immigrants? Or mixture of all those. Okay, so just, thinking about broadening back, I think, before we narrow down about some of the reasons why we use interpreters in our practice. Well, why do we bother? Well, I guess the obvious answer is that we want to have effective communication between ourselves and the patient. And there's a statutory obligation to ensure that our patients, if regardless of the language they speak or their ethnicity or their cultural background, that they have equitable access to services, that they're not discriminated against because they don't speak English or English well. And I guess ultimately, what we want is to increase the likelihood that the treatment we're providing to someone is effective. And communication is pretty central to that in most cases. Now, it's interesting because when I meet with staff groups, I'm very aware that there are the universal concerns that staff have, regardless, I find, of their background or their, you know, their training. But I thought it'd be useful to start with the patient and just think about what it is we're asking of the patient when we're asking them to communicate with us through an interpreter. I guess at a general level, we're asking them to place their trust in this person, who they may never have met before, as a broker of what's been said and what's been communicated between themselves and the health professional. And trust is pretty essential, really. If they can't do that, then really nothing else can follow in any healthcare setting, I would suggest, because a person isn't going to be open, they may not give you full information, you might not get a complete picture of what's going on. And I think in healthcare settings, people are exposed. They might feel vulnerable, they might feel distressed. You know, they may find it hard to show that side of themselves. We choose who we show those sides of ourselves to. So we're asking a client to really do that, maybe with a stranger. And we're also asking them to adjust their usual communication style. You know, we'll ask them to speak in manageable segments of speech so that the interpreter can remember it. Now, that's not our normal way. We don't normally think, how much should I say just now? And we don't get interrupted because people tell us we're saying too much. Well, I guess sometimes we do, but usually we don't in professional settings, in healthcare settings. And also, it probably makes a difference to that we probably place slightly different cognitive demands on the patient as well when we're asking them, you know, to maintain the thread, actually, of what's being discussed, particularly if it's complicated ideas. You know, so they will say something, they stop, it's interpreted, the clinician will say something back, it's interpreted. So there's a quite a cognitive load there. So these are the things we're asking, I guess, generally of clients. And then thinking more specifically about the concerns of the patient. Well, this slide will show some of the key concerns that I've come across over time. There's not a great deal of literature that I know of that's actually asking people who are being interpreted for how they find it. But these are some of the things that people have said to me. I guess trust again is a key one, particularly with people who have a history of trauma. So if you're working with asylum seekers, if they've had a history of persecution or torture or gender-based violence, then you know that is pretty much engineered to destroy trust in others. And I think because of the nature of the experiences that some people have, they may feel very vulnerable, they might feel ashamed, they may just want to keep it very private. And I guess I'm thinking about clients that I'm working with at the moment who actually I see a big difference in how they speak with me when they have an interpreter they know and an interpreter that's strange to them. I was working with an Iranian man last week and he completely became he communicated in a completely different way because the interpreter wasn't who he was expecting, and afterwards said, well, she could be an agent for the Iranian secret police, you know, and I can't say anything in front of her. Now, that's a very specific example, but it just illustrates how trust matters. And particularly if an interpreter comes from the community in which they're circulating, you know, that there might be concern about confidentiality, although interpreters are bound to keep confidentiality. Gender can be important, particularly again in those who have had experience of trauma that's been gender-based, but equally it might be relevant to people from BME backgrounds. Perhaps Muslim women may feel uncomfortable sitting with a male doctor and a male interpreter. That just might culturally and in terms of religious, I guess, expectations not feel comfortable. Okay, and then I guess I've put religion then. In my experience, there have been occasions when, for example, these are specific examples, but where a person who has been Christian, for example, in a Muslim country has left that country because they were persecuted because of being Christian, and then a Muslim person comes to interpret for them. That has been uncomfortable for people that I've worked with in the past. But again, it's very specific, and you wouldn't necessarily know this about the person you're working with. Patients might be concerned about the ability of the interpreter to accurately convey what it is they want to say. Some people may have, you know, may be able to understand English but not be able to speak it very well. So they may know about the they might be aware of how well the interpreter is interpreting, you know. And some people say to me, they didn't communicate half of what I said. They didn't capture what I was trying to tell you. I've had clients who would say this to me at the end of the session once the interpreter has gone. So there is an issue around feeling confident about the skill level of the interpreter as well. And dialects can be important. Your client might speak Farsi, for example, be Iranian, and the interpreter that turns up is Pakistani but speaks Farsi. That doesn't go down too well in my experience. Maybe because of accent or slight variations in dialect, it can be a barrier to communication. So these are nuances that it's hard to really know about in advance. But I think once you know that about your patient, then you know next time maybe to book a different interpreter or request that the interpreter is Iranian and not Pakistani, for example. Other concerns might be to do with the manner of the interpreter, you know, and that's often, I guess, quite apparent to both the clinician and to the client, whether this interpreter is sensitive to what's going on in the consultation. I have had interpreters who are sensitive but can't contain it, so they're shocked by what they hear and they'll go, "Oh my God, that's awful," you know, and they'll react in this way in the session because they are genuinely shocked and upset by what they hear. But what we need is for interpreters to be able to contain those responses. And other interpreters maybe sometimes can become over-involved in trying to facilitate what's going on. So I've had interpreters who the client will reply and they'll start speaking, you know, and when I check out what's happening, it's like, well, I'm just trying to explain that what you asked was this and you don't want that, you want this. And you know, and I think it's important to appreciate that the intention there is to assist understanding and to construct meaning in a joint way, and that's very positive, but it's for us to be monitoring what's been said and taking the lead in clarifying rather than asking the interpreter to do that. Again, these examples are really, I guess, drawn based on working with people who have a trauma history, but I have had experiences of maybe booking an interpreter. I remember I worked with a Chechen man on one occasion and couldn't get any Chechen interpreters in Glasgow. There weren't any. So he spoke Russian, so I booked a Russian interpreter. And she was a lovely, very able interpreter, very warm. And it was after about four sessions that he said to me, I cannot speak Russian to you, because he, as a Chechen man, saw Russia as his oppressor. These are things, I think, which it's okay to learn by mistakes and through experience, because often we can't know these things in advance. And it's hard for clients when we don't get the same interpreter each time, and we can request, but we can't guarantee it, and that's just the reality. Despite all these hang-ups, I think it's important to know that generally patients like having an interpreter. Again, this research is quite old, and I don't know how much is out there really, but they say they feel understood, and that they feel more compatible. This is a mental health paper with their therapist. And the research suggests that they're more likely to come back if they've had an interpreter at the initial appointment. And that fits with my experience within my own service when we've asked, I run a group, a men's therapy group, and we ask them when we review the outcomes, how helpful was it to have an interpreter? And always people say very helpful. So it's always rated as really essential part of the service that we provide. Are there any questions relating to that before we move on? Please feel free to chip in as we go along. We don't have to wait till the end. Okay. So just thinking, again, my background is mental health, but I think to think about it from, Reed healthcare perspective, and really I hope you can draw, analogies to your own practice. As psychologists, this is what we aim to do. We aim to make sense of the patient's description of their feelings and inner lives. As a medical doctor, you are aiming to make a sense of the patient's description of their experiences, their symptoms, their sensations. And in all consultations, regardless of our discipline, we're aiming to establish trust, reach a shared understanding of the patient's difficulties, mobilise hope and agree a way forward. And all of this relies on paying attention to what the patient's saying and the meaning of what they're saying and the meanings they're making. And usually this is predominantly derived from what the person tells us. I mean, we will also observe them, and perhaps that's more so for other disciplines like physio. You'll have an assessment that's based on how they behave to a greater or a lesser degree. That will be different across disciplines. For psychologists, how we say things as well as what we say and the tone and how responsive we're viewed by the patient as being is actually central to whether our treatment is going to be effective or not. So it's not surprising that we start to get concerned when a third person enters into this relationship. It's not comfortable. Maybe it's because, well, and this is what the research says, that clinicians who don't use interpreters very much, they're uncomfortable, they're uncertain, and they're anxious about it. And I think that's everybody's experience when they first start to use interpreters or if they only use them occasionally. And maybe it's something about just our automatic way of working becomes disrupted. Maybe it's something about feeling slightly scrutinised, our practice being monitored or watched, or it would be an interesting research paper to actually ask people why it's hard. But I think perhaps these are some of the reasons. And what's interesting, this study is interesting because it talked to psychiatry resident doctors and the patients they saw in their consultation. And what was interesting is that they both had completely different views about how effective and helpful the consultation had been. So the doctors viewed the clients as having had a poor experience of their service if they'd used an interpreter. Whereas the same client said that they felt they were satisfied with the consultation, they felt understood and they wanted to come back. So I guess it's easy, I think, to project the way we feel about the consultation on our patients, but the research is suggesting that they don't feel like we feel and they find it helpful.
I wonder whether or not that perhaps reflects a little bit of a bias. Patients, the usual sort of thing where patients perhaps
say they feel okay. That's possible, isn't it? Yes. Yes, possibly. Okay. So these are some of the concerns that are, I guess, captured in the literature. For a long time, the literature that I know of in terms of looking at what happens when you have an interpreter in a mental health consultation, in therapy, that's the literature I know, and I guess I think that's the literature that's looked at this the most. These are the sort of universal concerns. People are saying, I don't know what the interpreter's saying, how, you know, I don't think it's having a good impact on our therapeutic relationship. I don't feel that they're communicating what I'm saying in the same way as I do, that things are being lost. And how do I know what they've actually said? How do I know that the meaning's being conveyed? And these are universal themes. And just, I think if you, I would be interested to hear whether these are some of the concerns that you have as well. Do you have other concerns or thoughts about using interpreters? I'm sure you do, but do these seem relevant to you? Yeah, yeah. Okay. And I think a valid question for therapy anyway is, you know, does effective mental health interpreting require the interpreter to mirror the attributes of the therapist? Can the treatment be effective if they don't do that? And that's a very valid question, and I'm not sure. You might argue ideally that it would, that, you know, that they would, it would be better if they did. Okay, so there's been a shift away, though, in the recent literature to suggest that with increasing experience of using interpreters, these concerns actually start to settle down, and that therapists, anyway, can actually view the use of interpreters and working with interpreters as an enjoyable experience. And there's been a shift. Rachel Tribe is probably one of the people who publishes the most in this area, and she's published a couple of papers recently looking at the added value that you get when you work with an interpreter, and we'll talk a wee bit about this now. And these are some of the things that clinicians who regularly use interpreters are saying, that they're more aware, again it's a mental health context, but they're more aware of the non-verbal aspects of the patient's communication. They say that they simplify their language and they start to think more carefully about the jargon they use and the usefulness of that jargon, and move more towards using the patient's own words in their communication. And in my own service, I've noticed that shift in my own practice. So I rarely use diagnostic terms now like depression or anxiety, often because the constructs in people in non-Western countries don't translate. Anxiety isn't a construct I've spoke to a man from Cameroon. He said we don't have mental health problems in Cameroon. So that's the starting point, you know. It's not that we don't have anxiety, we just don't have, you know, this type of problem. So I will often just use very descriptive words like sad or low, and I'll take the patient's lead in the words I use to work to describe how they're feeling. So I will hear what they're saying, and this is good clinical practice generally anyway, to align yourself closely with what your patient's telling you, so that you get close to their experience of their illness or their disability. But we don't often do it, actually. It's more comfortable to sit with the terms we know. And when a person might say, well, I feel low, you might say, well, do you feel depressed then? You know, you convert it into something that's known to yourself rather than sitting with what they've given you. And I think we all do that. But when we use interpreters, there's actually a great deal of value in being forced to simplify and to stick with what the patient actually tells us. this is an aside, but I think it's relevant to yourselves because of the fact that you're pain practitioners. I've noticed, and it's been reported, that people from non-Western cultures will use somatic descriptions of psychological distress as a sort of, that tends to be the way people from non-Western cultures talk about distress. And I started to think about the complexities of this. So a lot of my clients will say, I am heavy, I have pain, it's very physical, their descriptions. And I will work, so if, you know, rather than saying, okay, that's you feeling down or low or depressed, I will, okay, so well, if you were better, what would that be like? I would feel light. And we'll work to make a, help the person shift to feel lighter. What would you be doing if you felt lighter? You know, so still work in the same way often, but use their words. But then I started to think about the ramifications if you're working psychologically with someone who has a physical illness or that causes them pain, and you want them to understand the psychological aspects of that pain condition and how they might work with that. It's complicated. If someone's, I guess, language is very concrete and physical to start with.
And I think one of the things that, that we try to do in the pain clinic is to integrate physical symptomology with stress.
Yes.
And low activity and those sorts of things, you know, the sort of biopsychosocial
thing.
But, yes. But I think we have to be aware that that's not necessarily
the model
that
everyone has.
And, you know, many people from the UK, you know, have that as well.
Yes.
But I think, you know, I've certainly had situations where that's a very, very difficult model for people to
buy into, yes.
It's far more sort of dichotomous.
Yes, yes.
You know, according to the particular culture.
Yes, and that might be Scottish culture, or it might be African culture, or Chinese. And I think what's important is that we hear what it is, what the constructs are that they bring, and we work with their understanding. And that's what we obviously do routinely. And clinicians often talk about feeling, having a more flexible and open approach to their therapy. And they talk about a joint struggle between the interpreter, the patient, and themselves to find the right words to achieve a shared understanding and I guess effective communication between the three parties. The term there is co-construction. And I think this is central to working with interpreters. And it was a light bulb moment. I only had it a few months ago, but I was at a conference run by Health Scotland looking called Every Word Matters, and it was promoting effective interpreting in the NHS in Scotland. And Graham Turner, who is a professor in translation studies at Heriot Watt in Edinburgh, was there. And he said that, you know, there is no such thing as literal interpreting. It does not exist. In every interpreting context, the interpreter is making active choices. They are choosing the words to convey the meaning. I mean, we've probably all studied a language, even at O-grade level, and you'll remember how when you did a translation, how it was an approximation, really, of what you know, your English, you're translating it into French, it never said exactly the same because the language doesn't allow for that. But the meaning may have well be the same. And interpreters are having to work in that way the whole time, really, to choose the words to convey meaning. And I've been struck by this. I did higher French, and when I work with French interpreters, I'm aware that I say something and what I hear coming back isn't the same. It's not exactly the same, but it's in the right ballpark, and it's okay. And I've learned to be comfortable with that's fine, actually. It's getting the meaning across. And sometimes I'll come back to the interpreter and say, well, what did you say there? Okay, well, I meant this. And because I speak a wee bit of French, I could tweak it. I can't do that with Arabic, you know, that I don't, and most of us can't do it with other languages either, but I think we have to trust that the interpreter is competent in this enterprise. And I think that's pretty central, actually, to effective working, that we have an interpreter we feel we can trust.
Pretty difficult if you've only met them
the first time. Them, well, that's true. And if you only intermittently work with interpreters, you're not going to get to know them very well. But I think one of the things I'm going to talk about is the importance of briefing your interpreter at the beginning of the session. And that gives you an opportunity just to get a little handle on what type of work they've done, you know, listen to their English, how well they interpret, you know. It's also an opportunity for you to say, this is what we're doing here. This is how we do it. This is what we're aiming for. This is a type of language I use. It's important you don't say that, but you say this. And that's the time to do that. And you get a sense at that stage, I think, of your the interpreter's competencies. If you like that interpreter, request them back. You know, you can do that. So I guess that the point is that the interpreter is active. They're actively making meaning. And ideally, we would join with them in that. The other thing that people have said is that the cultural information provided by interpreters can often be helpful. You know, I had a man who I saw who just stared at the floor for the whole session, and at the end, the interpreter said to me, he was being very respectful of you. I think he was also very depressed, actually, but that was another angle on it, you know, which was useful. And David, you had said, to what extent does an interpreter's beliefs and values influence what they say and how they communicate and how they interpret? Well, in light of, I guess, the fact that this is an exercise in constructing meaning, invariably, what they believe and know will influence how they communicate. And that's where there is value in the advanced briefing, so you can educate clients or educate interpreters. I run a group for men, as I mentioned earlier, and in that group we do mindfulness meditation practice, which is relevant to psychologists using pain because that's an element of pain management, as I understand. And what I encourage the interpreters to do is actually practice the meditation as well as interpret the guidance that I give. So that's quite a demanding process, but I've found interpreters have said to me, that's really quite hard for us to do, but we want to do the practice and we want to get the words. So can you give me a list of the words that you're likely to use to guide? So at least I have thought about it in advance so I can draw the words out more readily. And there are many interpreters in Glasgow who are very professional and want to work and are very, I guess, excited at the idea of working collaboratively with staff. And that's, I guess, one example. I'm just aware of our time. I think let's move on to the interpreters. So I guess this is the reality of the interpreters, I guess, working day in Glasgow. They're freelance staff, so they go to wherever the jobs are. So you may well have an interpreter who has had an appointment at the dentist, at the labour ward, and then comes to your clinic. That can happen, although normally if they've been up all night, they may have gone home to bed. But I have had people turn up at my appointments having been up all night helping interpret for a woman giving birth. So this is the range of the work they do. I guess just thinking about that, this is one of the values of briefing, because don't assume the interpreter knows that this is the pain management service, therefore we'll be thinking about pain. It's important to help them shift set, help them orientate to the work you're doing, maybe because they're tired or they've been rushing, or just to help them think about the language and the tone that they want to use, because it varies from setting to setting. One interpreter said, you know, that the words I use when I'm in court are completely different. The way I present myself, the way I communicate is completely different to when I work in mental health settings. So it helps if they have briefing. There's a real range of training. Interpreters can work for Glasgow Translating and Interpreting Service with no formal training, as I understand it. If they speak the language, they can interpret. But there's a range from no training at all, although I think GTIS now provides basic training, through to, you know, degree level training. So, you know, you don't know who's going to be walking through the door and how competent they're going to be. But, you know, there are some very good interpreters out there. And what we're asking is that they establish a relationship with that person you're working with, even just for that half an hour. And sometimes it's communicating distressing material. And if you're working in mental health settings, we ask them to do it in the first person. You know, then this happened, and then they did that, and then this happened, I felt like this. And if any of you have ever done role plays, you know, the way you're left feeling after a role play is it's amazing how quickly you identify with the person you're playing. And the ideas are often complex. And if there are understandings, the interpreter is the person who bridges that. And that's a stressful thing, because I think often the clinicians might assume the misunderstanding is coming from the interpreter, whereas it may well not be. It might be, you know, it could be at any level. It could be that the words we use actually don't have any equivalent in the person's language, the patient's language. Okay. So one of the piece of work that I'll just briefly touch on, we were interested in, well, we're asking our interpreters to do this work and in a mental health setting, to interpret for people in the first person, to describe quite, you know, distressing experiences or histories. We started to question, well, I wonder what impact that has on the interpreter. How does it affect them? And what are the challenges of interpreting in mental health settings? So this was a paper that piece of research that we carried out. It was published last year, and we surveyed interpreters. We had a very low response rate, but we analysed it, and I think some of the results are relevant and useful for us to think about this evening. These are some of the challenges that of mental health interpreting, but again, I think it goes across the board. So establishing rapport, displaying sensitivity, being non-judgmental. These are some of the things they found difficult about working with staff, that staff maybe didn't understand their role or didn't brief them, didn't really know how to use them, actually. And what's interesting is that the interpreters are concerned about conveying far more than just the content of the communication, and that was one of your questions as well, David. So they want to communicate the non-verbal, they want to capture the meaning, the content and the feeling, and facilitate a sense of direct communication. And this is something that's hard, but that's also an expectation they have of themselves. I'm not going to go into this in any great detail, but there were also emotional demands of interpreting in mental health settings. Interpreters struggle with clients' distress, particularly if what they're talking about has personal resonance. They struggle to contain their own response to sometimes what some of the things they're hearing, and they say they have to block out their feelings and there's no real outlet. Often what will happen is the interpreter will finish, they'll go off to their next job, and because they're bound by confidentiality, they're not really able to discuss what they've heard with anybody. So these are some of the things that make interpreting in mental health settings difficult for interpreters. what they're generally saying is that sometimes what they hear about stays with them, it's upsetting, it has an impact on a personal level and a professional level. Sometimes it causes interpreters to avoid taking mental health interpreting work. But they also, these are some of the things they said they liked about doing the work. They liked it when clients and staff showed that they appreciated their input. They liked knowing they'd helped facilitate effective communication. And the relationship with the client was rewarding. Seeing clients get better, knowing they interpreted well, seeing people feel less anxious when the interpreter arrived, they found that rewarding. So this is just a time for us to take a space, really, maybe just to reflect on some of the ideas, some of the material. And I wondered if we would have opportunity maybe 2 or 3 minutes just for some discussion before we come on to the final slides. Are there any questions? Yes, John.
Sometimes I have patients coming along whose English is perhaps not that great, who don't have an interpreter but bring family members with them, maybe a spouse, sometimes a teenage child.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that situation?
The guidelines are that you ideally wouldn't have a family member interpreting. Good practice guidelines would advise against it. I guess there are issues to do with confidentiality there, aren't there? You know, a mother may not ordinarily let her son know this much about her condition, for example, as he would learn if he was interpreting for her. And also, what would be the impact on him of having to be the bearer and hold that responsibility? I think it does happen, and I know in the past it's happened a lot. Ideally, if you know the person has poor English or in advance, book an interpreter. Now, it might be you do that and they say, no, I don't want an interpreter, I want my family to interpret. Now, that's different if that's an active choice. But if you have a husband maybe who's coming in saying, no, I don't want an interpreter for my wife, I want to interpret for her, that's not so active. And that's a difficult position, really. It may be, for example, if your patient is an asylum seeker, that a woman may have had experiences her husband doesn't know about that have caused her physical injury that resulting in pain now, and she doesn't want him to know about that. You know, so that would compromise what she could tell you, maybe, or it's a difficult position though to be in when it presents itself, I think. Yeah.
This might seem like a really silly question, one I should probably know already, but what's the process of making sure that we've got an interpreter for the right patients in advance?
Yes.
I mean, I'm assuming there's some form of questionnaire that patients fill in if there's a sign interpreter, otherwise they turn up on the door and we realise that a family member or a friend to interpret for them. That's how the news comes to me.
Yes.
I realise it's been less than ideal.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sure it does happen in quite regularly, particularly for people from Indigenous BME backgrounds. You know, when the referral letter comes through and there's no mention from the GP what their language is. If it's an asylum seeker, the GP would normally say this person speaks this language, they're from this country, and would include that information, though not always. And we would normally just ring up before the consultation, say, what language do they speak? But if a person's an immigrant from Poland, for example, or from a European country, I guess I would not make assumptions. And if I know that someone's not from this country, I would normally, in advance, make a phone call and say, does this person speak English? And if there's any doubt, I would book an interpreter. And it might... Mm-hmm.
That kind of presupposes that you know that who's coming to your clinic, whereas we can get that information on the patient's names and have the referrals, but the actual process of organising interpreter is outside my understanding in terms of our patients.
Well, I'll give you a number. You can basically... Greater Glasgow and Clyde Health Board has a partnership agreement with Glasgow Interpreting Services. So all you need to do is pick up a phone, ring them and say, I want an interpreter at this place, at this time, I want them to speak this language, and it's for half an hour. And they will arrive. They come.
I guess it's even before that process happens, in that we don't have control over our bookings. In that,
okay.
I know a lot of psychologists have got,
yes.
know who's coming day to day and have yeah. planning in advance in their diaries. But
so you wouldn't even know, you wouldn't have seen a person's notes.
We may have done, but we usually find out on the day who's coming. Mm. Although we can find out the information, but we often wouldn't know
yes.
when they're country,
yes.
So
I guess then it would fall maybe to people who are sending out your appointments to screen for that need.
I guess I don't. What I'm not sure of is, and anybody who knows the answer to this, I don't know if that happens.
Yes.
Well, I think it does happen sometimes.
It's just
not
a
good system because sometimes an interpreter turns up and sometimes they don't. And it's really only when you're seeing a patient for the second time that
yes,
you
realise.
Oh, you really do need,
yes.
need one for this patient. And then I think we just tell the people at the booking desk, and I think they have something that they don't need.
But I think there's value also, once you've met with a person, for then you to record, and in the letters you send out, say this person needs, so that information is then circulated to other professions who may come across the same person. You know, it's about having a system that thinks about it, and routinely most of us don't, because it's not a routine part of our everyday practice.
Can I ask, I find it very hard working with interpreters, actually. I think I lose an awful lot, I miss an awful lot, I think. But one of the things I find stressful is the time constraint.
Yes.
I think, to be honest, it just must take a lot longer. Partly because everything's being said twice.
Yes.
Actually, probably more than twice.
Yes.
Actually, and partly because, as you say, everything has to be slow and simple and in small bites and things.
Yes.
But I did one time rather over-optimistically and possibly naively request a double appointment for someone who was coming for interpreter, but that just didn't work. And I don't know whether anyone else in the that wasn't a sufficient reason to request a double appointment. Someone said I could have a new appointment, an appointment for a new patient, or an appointment for a return patient. She's 15 minutes, and I felt that wasn't going to be
long enough.
Be
so that was a managerial response, was it?
I assume so, or a
yes.
Your appointments desk.
Okay.
I've got A or B. They can give you A or B,
okay.
but not
yes, not C. Well, I mean, if we're thinking in terms of our statutory obligations, we have an obligation to enable this person to communicate. And if it means that if we get through half the amount of material in that session because there's interpretation, then that person's having half the service. So we need to book double appointments. And in psychiatry, they often do. They'll book longer sessions to allow for that. And GPs who have big caseloads with asylum seekers, they will as well.
I'm partly making a mental note to myself to follow that up,
yeah.
actually, and to remind myself that I think that probably is a sensible thing to do,
yeah.
and that I should probably explore whether that might be possible.
But also take the pressure off ourselves to get through. This person, you are not going to cover it at the same rate as you would someone who's speaking English. That's a fact. And I think to take the pressure off ourselves to get through the same amount in the same amount of time. Yeah. No?
You mentioned statutory obligation, and it's interesting that part of our service excludes people who speak a foreign language as their first language and as a pain management program if they require interpreters.
Okay.
And what I wanted to know, for very good reason, in that I imagine running group-type therapies with a number of interpreters interpreting at the same time must be the most possible, but I think you mentioned that you did run groups.
With lots of
just
interpreters.
Wondered, how do you facilitate a group with multiple interpreters?
It's not impossible at all, actually, although we were very apprehensive. The last group I ran, we had about four or five different languages being spoken, and there were only six men, I think, in that group. So in any group treatment, there are ground rules about, you know, speaking over each other, and I guess you just have to be very carefully observe those ground rules. So something would be said, the interpreters would interpret for their patient. If someone wanted to respond, then they would respond, that would be interpreted, and they would take it in turns. And it is possible, and it's actually not onerous at all.
Would you ever be doing that in a situation where you had some people who did speak
yes.
English and you had some
yes.
interpreters? Because I can see that there could be a dynamic.
Yeah, well, in this group we had men who didn't have any interpreters, but because they're asylum seekers, I think there's an acceptance that interpreting is essential, and that most people will require an interpreter. Now, if you have a group with someone who needs an interpreter and lots of Scottish people, that might be irritating to the other patients, maybe, or depends how you set it up. But it is possible to run programmes. But again, you cover less if you have an interpreter present, and that might have impacts that you need to think about and discuss, really.